Hello and Happy New Year from all of us at Science World. Today we look back at what was accomplished in space technology over the past year. George Putich will tell us about the current state of commercial air communications technology, and we talk with Caltech researcher Nicolette Sullivan about a new study that found if we took a few seconds of time before deciding on what to eat, we could resist the temptation of eating tasty but unhealthy foods and make a healthier food choice. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Space technology reached some important goals in 2014, but along with success, there were also some setbacks. Science World's Bob Doty gives us a look back at what shaped space technology over the past year.
The biggest achievements of 2014 happened in the last half of the year. In August, after a decade-long flight, the European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft became the first man-made object to enter into orbit around a comet, more than 400 million kilometers away. In November, Rosetta launched a probe named Philae that made the first soft landing on the comet. Its rugged surface caused the probe to settle down in partial shade, but lander manager Stefan Ulamek counseled patience.
Our original fear that the lander would overheat is not relevant anymore. We are in the shadow, so we can operate much longer in principle, but we have to be patient and wait for a little bit more time until we have enough solar power to reactivate Philae.
In September, the U.S. scientific satellite Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission, or MAVEN for short, entered an orbit around Mars with the mission of learning what happened to the red planet's atmosphere and water. MAVEN principal investigator Bruce Tarkovsky says scientists now know that Mars once had a much denser atmosphere and that it has changed significantly over the last few billion years. What they still don't know is how and why that happened.
We're trying to understand what the cause of that climate change has been, and we're looking at the role that escape to space may have played in removing the atmosphere and changing the atmosphere.
A few days later, MAVEN was joined by India spacecraft Mangalyaan, making India the first nation to reach Mars orbit successfully in the first attempt. Its mission was to develop technologies and experience for future explorations. In December, using its largest rocket, the Delta IV Heavy, NASA conducted a nearly perfect first launch and retrieval of its new space capsule designed for manned deep space explorations. Program manager Mark Geyer said, "It was hard to have a better day."
It's a difficult mission. It's a tough environment to fly through. It's tough objectives that we set for this flight. But it appears that Orion and the Delta IV Heavy were nearly flawless. Great job by the team.
In the future, the capsule will fly on top of a more powerful rocket, the Space Launch System. NASA plans to send it to circumnavigate the moon in 2018, while the first flight with astronauts is planned for 2021. The budding private space industry in the U.S. suffered two setbacks this year. In October, Orbital Sciences Corporation's cargo rocket Antares, bound for the International Space Station, exploded soon after liftoff. Later that month, Virgin Galactic's experimental space vehicle, Spaceship Two, broke up in the middle of a test flight, killing one of the two pilots. Both companies said the mishaps will not deter them from trying to develop reliable spacecraft for near-orbit flights. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
'14 was not a very good year for airline safety as two wide-bodied aircraft carrying over 400 passengers and crew were lost over water. In both cases, communication with the aircraft was suddenly lost before the pilots were able to report any problems. George Putich takes a look at the current state of commercial air communication technology.
It is not a widely known fact that airplanes flying large distances over the ocean and far from land are out of range of onshore radio systems and radar. Satellite communication and navigation technology, such as the GPS and satellite telephones, enables us to communicate with the airplanes and determine where they are located. The reason we don't have this technology everywhere is cost, says Michael Brash, an Ohio University professor of electrical engineering.
Being able to transmit messages through the satellite communication providers is an expense that up until recently there wasn't a great need for being able to keep track of aircraft second by second.
Pilots are required to make periodic so-called position reports so that air traffic control can remain current on their locations. In emergency situations requiring split-second decisions, however, they often do not have time to make that call. Earlier in December, the International Air Transport Association released a report recommending that each aircraft be equipped with a position reporting system independent of pilots. Brash says some of the member airlines are reluctant to adopt this recommendation.
It's mostly just a matter of dealing with the added expense and then putting a system in place that has, everybody agrees to the format and the standards and things of that nature. Technologically, there's no issue. We have satellite-based navigation systems such as GPS. We've had satellite communication technology for well over 20, 25 years now. So, technologically, this is a complete non-issue.
Additionally, some pilots are concerned about having on board an autonomous electrical system that cannot be disabled in the event of a fire. So far, only the flight data recorder, the so-called black box, is out of the pilot's control. Brash says after the Malaysia Airlines disaster in March, it became clear that something must be done.
We lost a wide-body airplane, and we have no idea where it is. And, in this day and age, that's just absurd.
In the meantime, the United States and Europe are preparing to implement a system called Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast, ADS-B, designed to periodically broadcast the airplane's position to air traffic controllers and other nearby aircraft. The system will be mandatory for some aircraft in Europe by 2017 and in the United States by 2020. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Speaking of aircraft communication and navigation technology, the GPS is one of today's most popular and widely used navigational methods. For this week's Science World Quick Quiz, what do the letters in the acronym GPS stand for? Is it A, Geographic Plotting System, B, Global Positioning System, or C, Geosynchronous Placement Source? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the Internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Researchers believe that bats are the source of the virus behind the current Ebola epidemic in West Africa. But a new study points to a different species than the fruit bats implicated in earlier outbreaks. Faith Lapidus reports.
The Ebola virus usually jumps from its animal host to humans through contaminated bushmeat. Hunters bring home an infected fruit bat or an ape or antelope that contracted the virus. While bats are unaffected carriers of Ebola, it is deadly for other forest dwellers. In earlier outbreaks, large mammals were also affected. But when researchers from Berlin's Robert Koch Institute arrived in Guinea in April to investigate the growing epidemic, they found no decline in the wildlife population. So they turned their attention to another source of transmission, theorizing that the virus was coming directly from its host, bats. Dr. Fabian Lindertz, who led the team, says they focused on hunters and their efforts to catch and kill fruit bats until they learned that the first victim of the current Ebola outbreak was a 2-year-old boy.
That changed a bit our point of view, and I thought we have to also look at children and their behaviors. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the breaking point, because the children don't hunt the fruit bats. But what they do in these villages, in general, they hunt the small insect bats with sticks under the roof and in trees, and wherever they find them, they will hunt them and kill them and roast them over the fire.
Through interviews in the boys' village of Meliandou, the researchers learned that local children often played in a large hollow tree that was home to a large colony of Angolan free-tailed bats. The presence of hundreds of the mouse-sized creatures presented the possibility of massive exposure to the virus. Writing in Embo Molecular Medicine, Lindert says the findings expand the range of possible reservoirs for Ebola.
What we want to say a little bit with this article is that since we don't know what is exactly the reservoir and what the virus does in the reservoir and how it's circulating and so on, we should keep an open view and also include in the investigations insectivorous bats and not only focus on fruit bats like most teams have done in the past.
Starting with a young boy in a small village in Guinea, Ebola has spread to more than a half dozen countries, infected more than 20,000 people, and killed more than 7,800. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.
Imagine being able to detect rare or invasive species, study biodiversity, or estimate fish abundance with just a scoop of air or a dip of water. Tom Bonsi tells us that technology, which was once considered science fiction, is becoming reality.
If you're old enough to remember the original Star Trek series, you might remember how crew members carried a versatile device they called the tricorder.
Make a swing around our perimeter. Scan for dichoronium in the atmosphere.
Landing parties from the Starship Enterprise used their tricorders on strange new worlds to instantly read out what was in their surroundings.
It's almost like something out there knows I'm scanning.
That was dreamed up in the mid-1960s. Now more than 40 years later, environmental researchers and surveyors can match Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, sort of.
Yeah, it's a really good analogy because essentially we can take a sample of whether it's soil or air, and in our case, water, and we can sequence the DNA out of it and tell you what's there.
Professor Ryan Kelly uses the technique called environmental DNA, or eDNA for short, in his University of Washington lab. The technology hasn't been miniaturized yet into a handheld device like on Star Trek, but give it a few years. For now, here's how the process works. All living creatures are constantly shedding or excreting their telltale DNA into the environment. In Kelly's Seattle lab, his team filters out and amplifies the genetic material. They are currently working with water samples collected from Puget Sound.
You take this gel, you walk over to the black light.
There it is.
And you turn that on.
Ryan says the cost of gene sequencing has plummeted in recent years. That makes DNA screening practical.
This is already very competitive and will be sort of a slam dunk for some monitoring applications in the near future.
Environmental DNA can be used in two ways. One is to identify all of the creatures that live in a certain place. The other is to confirm the presence or absence of a specific critter, typically an invasive or endangered species. Karen Goldberg runs the new eDNA lab at Washington State University in Pullman. She's one of the first biologists in the northwestern U.S. to take the tool from demonstration experiments to practical application.
It's extremely useful for species that are really hard to find.
Goldberg sees potential to get answers more efficiently, safely, and with less destruction compared to traditional survey techniques. Those could include snorkeling, netting, or using an electric current to temporarily stun fish.
I have spent many hours looking for species that I was pretty sure were there, looking under rocks, looking in water, doing all kinds of surveys.
The newer way to figure out what's where is rapidly catching on around the world. In Vietnam, zoologists are using it to locate the last wild specimens of the Yangtze giant soft-shelled turtle. In Trinidad, a researcher is using eDNA to track down endangered golden tree frogs. And in Madagascar, it's being used to identify amphibian diseases. For her part, Karen Goldberg has used the sensitive DNA screening to confirm the local extinction of a leopard frog in northern Idaho. She's also been hired to determine the extent of the spread of the New Zealand mud snail, a tiny invasive that's infesting lakes and streams in Washington state. Natural resource managers are looking for evidence that the eDNA methods are getting better at reporting what's there with a low number of errors. A related research goal is to more accurately pin down how long environmental DNA lingers and how far it can drift in different environments. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
Researchers in Britain have discovered a protein that plays a role in the spread of lung cancer. This finding could lead to a therapy to prevent cancer metastasis, reducing cancer deaths. Jessica Berman has the story.
Experts say 9 out of 10 people who die of cancer do so because of metastasis, where cancer cells travel through the bloodstream or lymph system to establish new tumors that are hard to treat. So finding a therapy that prevents the spread of cancer could improve survival. Researchers at the Cancer Research UK Manchester Institute, which is part of the University of Manchester in England, have discovered a protein called TIM1, which keeps cells from migrating but becomes defective in lung cancer. The disease is one of the world's leading causes of cancer death. Emma Smith is a senior spokesperson for the group. Smith says TIM1 holds cells together, but lung cancer breaks that bond.
And this means that the bonds holding the lung cells together are more easily broken apart, and the cells can move away more easily and move around the body. So this obviously is very important in lung cancer, because if the bonds come apart and the cells are free to move, this can allow cancer to spread or to metastasize.
Smith says the spread of cancer to places such as the brain and liver leads to organ failure and death. Researchers are now trying to develop a treatment to bolster the action of TIM1.
Ultimately, I mean, this is an early stage research, but what the goal would be is to design a therapy to target this molecule to restore its function, and this would actually stop lung cancer spreading. They would remain docked at the primary tumor.
An article describing TIM1 and its role in cancer metastasis is published in the journal Cell Reports. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. Today, we wanted to know, what do the letters in the acronym GPS of the popular and widely used navigation system stand for? Is it A, Geographic Plotting System, B, Global Positioning System, or C, Geosynchronous Placement Source? The answer is B. The Global Positioning System, a space-based satellite navigation system, was originally developed for the United States military. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
As we begin a new year, many of us are resolving to eat healthier and perhaps even lose some weight. In many cases, part of the problem we have in accomplishing these health and weight goals involves our never-ending struggle with food choices. When we choose a food to eat, should we grab that unwholesome snack such as the tasty leftover cake? Or should we go with a healthier selection of perhaps a carrot stick? Researchers at the California Institute of Technology, who released a new study on why we make certain food choices, have found that just waiting a couple of seconds before we grab that unhealthy item may help us to reject tempting but fattening foods and select healthier options. Lead author Nicolette Sullivan, who conducted the study with Dr. Antonio Rangel, joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about their research and findings and why pausing just a couple of seconds before making a food choice can help us break unhealthy eating habits.
There are several models for several theories for what is going on in your brain, and one of the most popular ones posits that you are weighing evidence in support of the carrot versus the chocolate cake at every moment. And then once you have enough evidence for one or the other, you make a choice. And this theory also posits that information that appears earlier on in that comparison process has a stronger weight in choice. For example, if you begin comparing the taste of the two foods first, that's going to have an overall advantage. It has a say longer in that comparison process. And so you might eventually end up choosing the cake.
Let's look at this. We're talking in this case a late night snack. So let's look at the role of logic versus impulse in making these food decisions.
Well, logic is maybe thought of as something you would think of that as more of a controlled, cool kind of process in which you're thinking calmly and having longer to deliberate. Whereas you could think of an impulsive process as something that happens very quickly and is not guided by a kind of higher level thinking. So one of the implications of this theory is if you make a decision very quickly, taste might be the only thing that has a say in that comparison process. So if you're being very impulsive, maybe taste only has come online. And if health comes online later, which is our theory, if you're making that choice really impulsively and quickly, taste might have not even had a say in that process, and so you're going to pick the worst item for you.
What kind of role does self-control play in helping us make these decisions?
Well, we think of self-control in our lab as a process by which a certain part of your brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and that's kind of on the top side of your brain, that area is able to sort of come online and tell you, you know, wait, this food is not very healthy. We're going to down-regulate your initial impulse, your reaction to the taste of those foods, your initial want of the foods. We're going to downplay that because in the long term, that's bad for you. And so this is a process of self-control. We've seen this in several of our fMRI studies in the lab. And our study posits that this self-control might partially be caused by the timing at which these taste and health attributes start to come online in that choice process. For example, if health never comes online, you can't exert self-control because you don't have the information to do so. So what we've found is that the difference in the times at which taste and health are processed, that timing is significantly related to your ability to execute self-control. And in fact, that relationship is so strong. It's stronger than many other things that people use to study self-control. For example, impulsivity questionnaires, it's stronger than the relationship between IQ and impulsivity. It's stronger than a lot of those relationships. Just this small timing parameter, this 200 millisecond difference.
Tell us about this technique you developed.
If it is true that information that appears at different times has a different weight in your final choice, we need to measure that timing. And, you know, the sub-second level is just not available to many psychological techniques. fMRI, which is a really great method to understand the cognitive processes, the neural processes behind choices, is too slow. We are looking and wanting to look at things that are on the millisecond level. So we wanted to see whether motor movement, you know, reaching your hand into that refrigerator, whether that can give us some insight in the cognitive process, because we do know that motor movement happens sort of at the same time as your thinking.
So what did your experiments reveal regarding food choices? Is it taste or health?
It's both for most subjects. Their final choice is driven by both health and taste. However, for 32% of our subjects, health never drove choices. There are several implications from this study. For example, if it's true that health is coming online later for you, waiting a little bit longer to make your choice may allow that comparison process, may allow that health information a chance to catch up. You know, if health is coming online in your choice just a few milliseconds before you make that choice, it doesn't really even have a chance to have a say. So if you let that decision, let that evaluation process go on for longer, health might have a chance to influence choice.
That was Nicolette Sullivan from the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, in Pasadena, California. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.